Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hej alla kära vinpratarna och lyssnare och välkomna till avsnitt 104. Idag ska ni få träffa Philippe Gigal som är vinmakare på vinhuset eller producenten Gigal. De flesta av er känner säkert igen namnet Gigal. Det här är ju en producent som gör viner från framförallt från norra Rhône. De har ju sitt säte eller sin hemmaplan i Cotroti i de nordligaste delarna av norra Rhône. Gör även viner från södra Rhône och sådär. Men det är norra Rhône som är deras stora grej. Och jag träffade honom här för någon vecka sedan. I Grand Hotels vinkällare. Nere i deras lilla provningsrum de har där. Mycket trevligt. Och ja, vi snackade helt enkelt. Vi snackade om Rhône och vi snackade om Gigal. Och vi snackade om Viognier och annat spännande. Och fick även testa en hel del kul från deras portfölj. Så att... Häng med helt enkelt och hoppas ni får en trevlig stund. Ha det så gott!
For starters, welcome Philippe Gigal to Vinpratarna. Nice to have you here.
Nice to meet you.
Have you had a good stay in Stockholm so far?
Excellent, so far so good, excellent.
So far so good. And how, what have you been doing here for now? You've been meeting with the press and meeting with importers and sommeliers or what?
Absolutely. I had the chance to... I've had a great schedule organized by our importer here in Sweden, Vinunik. Mm-hmm. And yes, I met a lot of sommeliers. I met the press, of course, yeah. And very interesting meetings with the final consumers as well. So mm-hmm. We did some what's so-called winemaker's dinner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To meet the people that drink our wines on the market, and it's also very important to us.
Nice, nice. Start off by telling me a little bit about your way into the business. I mean, we're going to talk about the estate, Gigal, as well. But I know you were quite young when you actually entered the business and took over as a winemaker. You were 22, is that right?
Yes. I was young, yes and no. I have two examples.
Yeah.
My father and my grandfather. My grandfather started to physically work as a vineyard guy. He was 14 years old, so okay. I think he was very young.
Yeah.
And my dad took over the winery from my grandfather because of health issues when he was 17.
Okay.
So arriving at 22, I was not really, really, really young.
Compared to them, no.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah.
But was it... were you always sure that you were gonna enter the wine business, or did you ever had any other plans? Maybe some people, some winemakers that are born into wine, seem to try to do other stuff before, and then they sort of return. But you were determined from start that you actually were going.
Surprisingly, I never changed my mind. So I think if we had met when I was 5 years old, I wanted to do the same job as my father and my grandfather. And I've always been more than very much on wine. So it's always been very logical for me to work in the family business. And it's even worse than this. I have no real other passion. than wine. So I've always orientated all my studies to, you know, study enology, winemaking, and, you know, subjects that are directly implicated or involved with the wine.
Yeah. Do you remember any really early wine memories? I mean, were like how old were you when you tasted wine for the first time?
I do remember the first time I drank a little bit too much, and I was definitely too young to drink. But it was like a big party in the cellars, and I was finding very strange that people were leaving some wine in the glasses. So I got rid of.
You helped them.
Absolutely. I got rid of these remainings. I helped them. And yes, this is probably a very old memory. To be honest, my parents always told me that I had my first very little sip of wine during my baptism, but mm-hmm. I don't remember this at all. The only thing I can tell you is that I've done the same for my boys. So they got a little sip of wine for their baptism.
Yeah.
and that's it. Yes, I think... we have an approach in the family. My parents had an approach, and I have an approach where wine is not something that should be forbidden. Mm. In the way that my feeling is that if you forbid something very, very hardly to a kid, the day he will have the possibility to drink, he will probably drink too much. I am the very fortunate dad with my wife of twin boys that are 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And since a very young age, they're always allowed to smell. Of course, they don't drink wines, but they're allowed to smell. And from time to time, they ask, can we try? Can we taste? So, you know, they use their little fingers mm-hmm. to try the wine. And by doing this, you know, first of all, they see that there's, you know, no real interdiction, or there's nothing really forbidden about wines. And I'm convinced they will have a very easy approach on wines in the future. Whereas, you know, I know families where, no, you don't touch, you don't smell, you don't do anything. And unfortunately, when these young adults turn 18 years old, you know, they spend a lot of time in the bars drinking beers. And so it's not my vision of wine, of course.
No.
Yeah. When it's forbidden, it's exciting. I agree with you.
But you studied enology, but you also studied business, right?
Yes, the fact is that I've been extremely fortunate to finish my enology studies when I was very young. So I was 21 years old. And my dad very kindly told me, well, 21 years old, you still have a little time if you want to. So I used the fact that in France, when you've studied science, and of course, enology is very much about biochemistry and organic chemistry, you always have the possibility to jump into, you know, economics and MBA. So I finished my studies with an international MBA provided by the OIV, the International Office of the Wine. And it gave me the opportunity to travel in 18 countries producing wine in the world in 10 months of time. It's been fascinating to move to the different places and talk about business, talk about marketing, of course, about wines, but not only. I already was a winemaker. So I had the opportunity to meet a lot of great winemakers around the planet and exchange some technical skills with them.
Mm. So you were 22 when you took over the job as a winemaker. Which one was your first vintage then?
So my first vintage as an enologist was 1997.
Mm.
So I was born 1975, so I was really 22. But I've been very fortunate to you know, see some changes in the winery before my arrival. And one of them is the reception of the grapes, which is very much computerized. And my dad is from another generation. He's never touched a computer his whole life. So this new system has been set at the winery in 1993. Mm-hmm. So it means that since 1993, I am the one who's running the computers and the reception of the grapes. So
okay.
I was 18 years old in 1993, and let's say it's my very first touch or approach with wine, for sure behind my dad's shoulders. So he was taking the decision at the time, and I was happy to learn from him.
Mm-hmm.
I still learn from him, of course.
But he's still involved?
Yes, very much. Yeah, yeah. My dad is in an excellent shape. Mm. Is the kind of father who wakes up at 4:30 every morning. He's at 5 o'clock in the office, and when I arrive very late, around 6:30 in the morning, he tells me that I'm already 1 hour and a half late. So no, he's in very good form. He's very punchy. He's very pushy as well. I think we make a very good duet together.
Oh, nice. So maybe we should talk a little about the estate itself. It was founded in 1946, right? Can you just tell us a little about the story from 46 until
it's
now?
It's a great story because, of course, the estate starts in 1946, but, you know, the history of our winery is directly linked to the history of the people, and it starts with my grandfather, Etienne. So I had a remarkable grandfather. As I told you, he started at a very young age, at 14 years old, in the vineyards. He was a very hard worker, a physical worker. So, you know, by his work, his dedication to what he was doing, he then became the vineyard manager of the company he was working in. And then he said it could be interested to know how to make wine. So he started in the cellars as a trainee. And then, you know, he became the cellar master. And eventually he ran another winery, also located in northern Rhône, in our small village of Ampuy, named Vidal Fleury. Vidal Fleury is the oldest winery of the entire Rhône Valley, founded in 1781. Mm-hmm. So obviously very different from Guigard.
Yeah.
And my grandfather has had the chance to run this winery during about 10 years before World War II. Then he's done like most French, he's been sent to the war. And when he came back from the war in 1946, he made a very incredible and crazy choice. He went to his boss, Mr. Vidafri, the owner of the winery, and said, you know, I'm in a perfect situation. I run a very prestigious winery. I'm in charge of the technical part, and I'm very happy about what I do. But I've had a son. So my dad was born in 1943, and he said, maybe one day I would like to have the chance or the opportunity to share my passion with my son. So don't take it too badly, but I would like to start my own business. Mm-hmm. And he started Guigard the 1st of January 1946 from absolutely nothing. So very often I have people asking me how many hectares at the beginning. Well, it's very simple, zero. my grandfather had nothing. He had a very strong and reliable experience, but, you know, there were no heritage at the time, for sure. So he started modestly, but he started with something very important. He started with the roots, the philosophy, the aim of what we do today. So there's something important to realize is that at that time, profitable businesses in wine were not quality-oriented.
No.
They were volume-oriented. Mm. So everything that was working well was a matter of how much wine do you make. Mm. And my grandfather had a very different vision. He had a very different idea. He was interested in quality. Today, the word quality doesn't mean much. Everybody wants to do quality. Mm. Plus, you have you know, the quality laws, insurance, etc. So this is a very different word from the time, you know, my grandfather was interested in quality, and he started this business saying, "I want to produce quality wines, and more important, every appellation I'm going to touch, I want to be a reference, a quality reference in each appellation." And this is how today we achieve a Côte du Rhône, which is very much recognized on the market as a quality reference.
Yes.
So we kept the same philosophy with my dad. We are very comfortable with this philosophy, and we have to thank my grandfather for this. For sure.
He started off, but the first land that he actually started to to grow, where he started to grow, was that in Côte-Rôtie?
It was in Côte-Rôtie.
Okay.
The first purchase done was in Côte-Rôtie. It's difficult to realize it today, but at the time, nobody wanted to buy Côte-Rôtie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amount of money you could get from a vineyard in Côte-Rôtie was miserable compared to the money you could make with a negotiation business, buying wines in bulk and aging the wines, selling them afterwards. So it started in Côte-Rôtie. Very quickly, he got, you know, very prestigious vineyards. So one of his first purchases has been La Mouline in Côte Rôtie. So he was in love with this vineyard. When he arrived at 14 years old, he saw the vineyard of La Mouline, and he saw a house in the village. And he was 14 years old. He had not a single penny in his pocket. But he said, if I have the chance to succeed, I would like to buy this vineyard and I would like to buy this house. The house is the place where we have our headquarters, our offices today.
Still?
Yes.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing. Yeah,
and La Mouline is, of course, an important vineyard to us.
Yeah, indeed. And a lot has happened since 1946, of course. You're really a big player. So do you know, could you say how many hectares do you have today, all?
Yes. You know, the fact that we take over properties is something that we still do today. So we are in a position where we are very much quality in high-end vineyards. Today, our total surface of vineyards is 75 hectares.
75?
Yes, in Northern Rhône. 75 hectares is not a very impressive figure, like there could be in Bordeaux or in other regions. But to be really honest and transparent with you, if I had to choose 75 hectares in Northern Rhône today, I would choose the one we have. That is to say, our idea has never been to go for 200, 300, 400, 500 hectares, wherever it is. The idea has always been to select the very best terroirs, go to the very best parcels in each appellation where we work. And this is really what we want to achieve with my father. So when I entered the winery in the 90s, I would say we were probably owning around 20, 25 hectares. So we've done a big step since the 90s, and it's a recent step. We are not tired. But we have a lot of projects, for sure.
I can imagine. But you're not only in Côte Rôtie today.
We have a very very comfortable and very interesting property in Condrieu, with about 10 hectares of Condrieu. We have an outstanding property in Saint-Joseph. We took over the former Jean-Louis Grippa estate, who was considered as the true quality reference of Saint-Joseph. We have... We think it's modest, but let's say we have a normal property in Hermitage of 4 hectares only. And we also have vineyards in Croz-Hermitage, but we are in the most quality-oriented parts, such as the village of Croz-Hermitage, Larnage, interested by Gervon, Mercurol, etc., etc. So, we could have decided to buy 100 or 200 hectares of land in Croz-Hermitage on the flat part of Les Châssis. And today I could come to you with a property of 200 or 300 hectares. But it's never been the idea. The idea is really to concentrate on the very high profile quality vineyards.
Yeah. But when you do, like, I know we have, there's a Châteauneuf du Pape from you as well.
For sure.
Sustainable. So is it your land that you own there as well?
We don't own any land in Châteauneuf du Pape. Not revealing too important secrets. The Châteauneuf du Pape that you see in Sweden and that we produce is made with a partnership with over 40 different estates in Châteauneuf du Pape. So that's huge, that's gigantic. And the fact is that there are some people that we work with for the past 4 generations. That is to say, there are some estates. My grandfather was buying the Châteauneuf du Pape for Vidal Ferry when he was working for Vidal Ferry. So, it's very long-term relationships. For quality reasons, rather than buying the grapes and bringing the grapes back to the north in Côte Rôtie, we prefer by far that the grapes are vinified in the south in Châteauneuf du Pape. And the idea is to bring wines back to the north as soon as possible. So it means that right now we are selecting the 2016 vintage in order to have the wines home by the end of the year. So it is... We take things at a very early stage. We want to control as much as possible during the lifetime and the aging of the wines, of course.
Côte Rôtie, the name itself, it means sort of the burnt slope or
roasted
like
slope.
Roasted slope,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But can you tell us about the climate? How is it the climate there in reality?
Well, I think if you take literally the two words côte rôtie, roasted slope, you understand very well what happens in our region. So first of all, it's a very impressive vineyard. We're talking about a vineyard where slopes can easily reach 100%, 120%, so 40 degrees, 50 degrees. It's extremely steep. Mm. It's extreme conditions. And of course, it's a very interesting climate. So we are only 25 minutes south of Lyon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different climate. We feel very much closer to the southern part of France than the northern part of France. And, you know, if you look back the Roman time, because we are very much interested by the Romans, linked to the fact that Côte Rôtie is a place where we grow grapes and make wines for the past 2,400 years.
Mm.
So we have a tremendous history of 24 centuries. And if you look at the Roman time, you realize that the place where we live, Ampuy, Côte Rôtie today, was linked to the southern Rome. It was linked to Narbonne, mm-hmm. which is a big city close to the sea in the south, whereas Lyon, Lugdunum, was considered as the capital of northern France. So, you know, there's really an important gap between Lyon and Ampuy, Vienne, where we live. So I would say in terms of geology, and in terms of climate, we feel closer to the south than to the north.
Mm.
Of course, we keep specificities that are unique to the northern Rhone.
Mm.
You know, it's not the same climate as Châteauneuf-du-Pape at all.
No.
In Châteauneuf-du-Pape, there can be influences of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. In our place, it is more continental climate, and the fact that it's continental, it can get extremely warm during the summer. So this is the roasted part of Côte Rôtie.
But from a vinification point of view, what is the key? I mean, to keep the freshness and to keep the energy in the wines. The temperatures are so high.
My feeling is that in wine, like in life, everything is a matter of balance. So I very much believe in balance in everything I do. I try to teach that to my sons as well. But it's very true for the wine. So balance is a matter of observing. And it's very important because Côte Rôtie today is different from Côte Rôtie 20 years ago.
Mm.
I can assure you that it's only the people dressed with jackets, suits and ties working in the offices in Paris that are wondering if there's a global warming and mm-hmm. if there's a climate change. We work in the fields, we work outside, and we know it's real that there's a global warming. So to answer your question, I would say that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the key was very much in being patient. We're in the extreme northern Rhône. Côte Rôtie is the northern appellation of the entire Rhône, mm-hmm. and it was a matter of picking the grapes at full maturity, that is to say, the later, the better. And it was important not to be too impatient and to take some time to ripe the grapes, to get a full phenolic ripeness, to get the sugars, etc. With the climate change, it can be very different. So it depends on the vintages. My comment is completely true for 2016.
Mm.
2016 was a late climate vintage. Mm. So we picked the grapes until mid-October very easily. And we've been spoiled or very interestingly, I would say blessed by the fact that we had an incredible Indian summer. So we had extremely warm temperatures until 2 weeks ago only.
Okay.
So in October, we had temperatures close to 30 degrees Celsius, which is very unique.
Wow.
And very exceptional. So we've saved the 2016 vintage thanks to this incredible season. If we talk about the previous vintage, 2015, I am convinced that we've made among the very best wines we've ever made at the winery.
Okay.
I have a limited experience of 23 years. My dad is vinifying for the past 54 vintages, and my dad says it's the best vintage he's ever seen. and is easily comparing 2015 to 1961, his first vintage, 1945 or 1929, that are true references in the Rhone Valley. So the secret for 2015, I'm very happy to share it with you today.
Hmm?
It's the opposite of 2016. The sooner, the better. The climate was extremely mild. There were extremely warm temperatures in July and August. So when we decided that it would be time in December to pick, it was really time. So we've been able to do very quick harvest and pick very early September to keep the balance, to keep the acidity, to keep, you know, I would say a good energy to the wines. Mm. And I'm convinced we succeeded.
Okay. So it's So
from one year to another can be very different, and of course there's no rule, but yes,
but
observation.
Harvest time is not that you're on a very high altitudes or something. It's harvest time
is important.
Yeah. I would say among the regular Swedish wine drinker, I think your Côte d'Or Rouge is probably the most famous, because it's always up there when the wines that most bang for the buck, sort of. It's still quite cheap and it's really, really good quality.
Mm-hmm.
What's the secret behind that wine? Well, how can you still keep it at that price level, and what is the key to this consistent quality of that wine?
As you could imagine, it's first a lot of work. But behind the work, there's also ideas, and I'm very happy to share the ideas with you. Both my dad and I, and my grandfather before, always kept in mind that, you know, people have a lot of choices. It's especially true in Sweden. You know, you go to a Monopoly shop and you see, you know, a diversity of wine, which is truly outstanding. We think that someone who's never heard about the Rhone Valley decides to buy something from the Rhone. To be honest with you and make you smile a little bit, I would love this person to grab a bottle of La Mouline, La Turque or La London as his first experience in the Rhone Valley.
Mm.
But I'm convinced it will never happen.
No.
That is to say, the first experience of the Rhone Valley is probably through a modest appellation, that is to say, Côte du Rhône.
Mm.
And, you know, if this person grabs a bottle of Côte du Rhône Guigard, taste it the same day in his house and say, it's not bad, I think we've lost this person, because nowadays there's a lot of not bads or okay wines all around the world. But if this person grabs the bottle of Côte du Rhône Guigard, opens it and says, wow, this is really something. Mm. This is a wine that has a strong personality. It's balanced, important word to us. The price is okay. It's not the cheapest, but it's not too high as well. And there's so much pleasure in this bottle for the price. I think we have achieved our goal. So we are very distinctive with this Côte du Rhône. Technically speaking, it's an unusual Côte du Rhône because it's not Grenache based, it's Syrah based. So we have a majority of Syrah in this wine. It shines distinctively in the shelf, you know, with this, I don't like to use the word consumer approach, but the fact that we realize that we're probably one of the only winery in France that has no name for his for the Côte du Rhône. You know, all my colleagues have a nickname or a brand name for the Côte du Rhône. We sell Côte du Rhône Guigard, and we think it's enough.
Mm.
You know, people rely on the appellation and on the brand or the family. It's the same for us.
Mm.
And this is very much what we try to do with this wine. So we have a lot of course, a lot of technical points that you know, I could underline to, for example, show a wine with a bit more age.
Mm.
I've done a store check yesterday.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
We've been to a shop and I had the opportunity to taste almost all the Côte du Rhône that are, you know, on the shelves in the Monopoly.
Mm.
Everything I've stated is from the 2015 vintage, which is a great vintage.
Mm.
The only wine that has a different vintage is the Côte du Rhône Guigard.
Mm.
It's a 2012 So of course the balance will be different.
Yeah.
Our key or our secret is that we have the capacity through our cellars, our vision of aging, to keep a good freshness, to keep a good fruit in the wine, but not only. There's a complexity linked to the age of wine. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a texture in our wines that I think is very unique. So I'm very happy to sit next to my colleagues' wine on the shelves here in Sweden. But definitely, you know, the wine that is inside the bottle has got a very different profile. It's very different shape.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Also, you, we were talking about vintages, I've read some interviews with you before, and I get the feeling that you sort of embrace the differences in vintage and try to make a new wine each year rather than making the same wine every year. Is that right?
It's completely true. First of all, I think that it's a common point that the French have in general. The impact of the vintage in France is very important. I've been fortunate to spend some time in Australia, to spend some time in California. Because of the weather, they have a capacity, let's say, to make more or less the same wines, or I should say wines with more or less the same balance every year. The balance can be extremely different in France because of the vintage. So I think the print of the vintage is important, and I also think it's a strength. I would feel extremely bored to make the same wine every year. So I can assure you that even 10 minutes before the grapes arrive to my winery, I don't have a very precise idea of the way I'm going to vinify the wines. So let's call it the artistic part of our job. You know, from one vintage to another, we'll take extremely different decisions. You mentioned something very important regarding going in the direction of the vintage. And this is a true philosophy of our winery. What I'm going to say now is not a criticism against an enologist. I am myself an enologist, so I'm not going to criticize, but I would just like to mention the fact that, in general, enologists or winemakers have a tendency to counterbalance things. And I can give you two logical and classical examples. Let's say we have a vintage that is showing as a light and delicate vintage. So we see that the extraction of the color is extremely slow in the must. We see that the tannins are not going out of the berries very easily. So the natural tendency of an enologist or winemaker would be to say, okay, I have to do a little bit more pumping over. I have to do a little bit more extraction in order to come back to something normal. The other example would be the opposite. In 2015, as we're talking about an outstanding vintage, 1 hour after the grapes are in the vats, the must is completely black. And you already feel some tannins in the must. So you know that the extraction is going to be very important. It's going to be very fast. So the reaction of an enologist would be to say, ooh, I have to be careful. You know, I shouldn't do too much pumping overs. I shouldn't do too much extractions. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to make huge wines. I very much respect this vision of the winemaking, but I truly think the opposite. That is to say, my vision is that if a vintage is born as a delicate and elegant vintage, we should be very soft and very mellow with the extraction. Whereas if a vintage is born as big, with big color, big tannins, why not using the potential of quality that are in the berries to express this strength, the color, the tannins, etc. Both philosophy are possible, but I very much embrace the second one.
I'm thinking we should try some wines just in a minute, but you also just talk a little bit, because you Syrah is your sort of the main grape for you.
Yes, Syrah is the main grape of the reds, and we have a real passion and dedication for the Viognier as the whites.
Tell us a little bit about the Viognier. How is what kind of grape is it to work with?
It's a fantastic grape because it's a very difficult grape to grow. It's not easy at all. Let's say 40, 45 years ago, there were somehow 9 hectares of Viognier planted on planet Earth.
Wow.
It was the Condrieu appellation, and that was it. So Viognier was about to die, and nobody was very much interested in Viognier, linked to the fact that it's a grape that had a natural tendency to degenerate. So it was producing 1 year out of 3 years, very capricious, very low yields, of course, and more important, you know, unreliable. There's been a lot of work done in the appellation in order to sort the best vines, in order to reproduce these vines and be able to select some Viognier vines that would produce every year, that would have a little bit more vigor, but that would keep the quality, of course. And we have achieved it in Condrieu through the replantation of our appellation, which is today close to 185 hectares. So you compare 40 years ago, 9 hectares, 185 today. We have succeeded. But not only. That is to say, the Viognier started to travel down the Rhône Valley in the Ardèche district through the Vin de Pays in the Languedoc. It moved to California.
Yeah,
I've tasted some Viogniers in California 30 years ago, as planted by the Rhone Rangers at the time. It went to Australia, to New Zealand, to South Africa. I taste some Viognier from Greece, from Italy. And, you know, there's a lot of regions around the world that are interested by the Viognier. And, of course, I'm very glad about it because it's a grape that deserves it. The issue will be that the flavors of the Viognier are extremely distinctive. So these beautiful aromas of white peaches, apricots, can easily be found around the world. What would make Viognier in Condrieu very unique is the balance. That is to say, we are able to keep this richness in the nose and in the mouth, but the wines are not flabby. The wines are not waiting on your taste buds. They have a good minerality. They have a, you know, an extremely shining approach in the mouth. And this is really what we want to achieve in Condrieu, keeping the richness, but avoiding the heaviness or the flabbiness in the wines.
Nice.
We do this thanks to the soils and the climate. So let's call it the terroir.
Yes, so now for the fun stuff, to try some wines as well.
Theory is good, practice is better.
Exactly. The combination is best. So now you're pouring...
I'm pouring a white Côte du Rhône, 2015.
Yeah.
It's a great opportunity for me to present this wine through a very interesting and simple sentence. This white Côte du Rhône is a Southern Rhône wine made by Northern Rhône people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we're involved in the southern part of Côte du Rhône, but we have a northern vision of Côte du Rhône, makes that we are going to use grapes for the blend that are not traditional grapes
mm-hmm.
from the Southern Rhône. So a white Côte du Rhône is theoretically Grenache Blanc based, and there can be a touch of Clairette, Bourboulenc, and other southern grapes. The fact that we have a northern vision makes that the majority grape in this wine is the Viognier.
Okay.
So we're talking about 60-65% Viognier here.
All right.
And that's, of course, very important in the aromatic expression of this wine.
Yeah. The white peaches you were talking
Absolutely.
About earlier.
White peaches and apricot
really,
flavors
yeah.
are very obvious on the wine. We balance
citrus.
The Viognier in the south with the Roussanne from the Southern Rhône as well, but which is originally from the north.
Mm.
We have a touch of Marsanne. We like Clairette and Bourboulenc in small proportions, about 8-10% for these two grapes.
Mm.
And the famous Grenache Blanc
mm.
that I mentioned is almost forgotten. It's 2-3% of
okay.
the final blend.
Okay.
So once again, it's a Southern Rhône wine made by Northern Rhône people.
Interesting.
So you see, you find the richness and the fatness of the Viognier
yeah.
in the mouth, but it's extremely well balanced, you know.
The acidity and also some spicy.
The spices, the freshness
mm.
that you have.
Very nice. Both refreshing and I mean, it's got a great core to it.
Yes, yeah. good energy.
Yeah, good energy. Lovely.
The next wine is also a white wine, and it's the reference of Viognier, this time with Condrieu.
Hmm?
So we're tasting a
Condrieu. So this is 100% Viognier.
Yes, it's 100% Viognier, and more important, it's the birthplace of the Viognier.
Hmm?
So Condrieu is a place where we grow the Viognier grapes for the past 2,400 years.
Mm.
It's really, historically speaking, a reference for Condrieu.
Yeah, and this is 2013.
This is 2013.
What about that vintage?
2013 is an interesting vintage for its concentration.
Mm.
The reds are quite tough. They are quite powerful and structured. The wines were very well concentrated. They kept a good acidity. They kept a good balance. And I think it's a good match with the richness of the Viognier once again.
Yeah.
So I don't like to age the Viognier or the Condrieu too much. I would recommend 2-3 years maximum.
Mm.
So let's
so
say
sort of
two,
perfect right now.
2013 is perfect right now.
Absolutely. Do you put it in oak in some time?
Or? Yes, the Condrieu is vinified for 1/3 in York barrels
mm.
and 2/3 in stainless steel in order to keep the freshness.
Yeah, yeah. You get
it's a little hint of oak.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's very well integrated into
very
the wine.
Well, yeah.
It's more a matter of adding an aromatic complexity
mm.
than really marking the wines.
Real nice, but on the palate I get almost like not tropical, but a little bit of mango and that kind
Absolutely.
Of kind of fruit.
Yes,
as well.
Tropical fruits, a lychee.
Mm, yeah, lychee mm-hmm. indeed. Very nice.
If everybody was drinking a bottle of Condrieu every day, trust me, the earth and life on earth would be much better than it is.
It would probably be peace on earth.
Yes. Do you want to switch to the reds?
Let's go for the reds, yeah.
Okay.
And now we have the... so go for the Cros Hermitage.
Yes, Cros Hermitage is a good idea.
Yeah. And this is also a 2013.
2013 vintage. Cros Hermitage... is an important and interesting appellation for us because if you consider the Côte du Rhône as an entry door
mm-hmm.
of the Southern Rhône wines,
mm-hmm.
Cros Hermitage is definitely the entry door of the Northern Rhône wines.
Mm-hmm.
So you have here an expression of a pure Syrah from the north, 100% Syrah, and
in order to describe the philosophy we have behind this wine, when we make it, we want people to have the impression to crush a Syrah grape in their mouth. Mm-hmm. That is to say, we always have a freshness in Cruz Hermitage. We always have a spiciness that is very typical of Northern Rhone Syrahs.
Mm-hmm.
So these beautiful aromas of white pepper and spices mm-hmm. are extremely typical of Cruz Hermitage. We had a good ripeness in 2013, and you probably smell the black currant as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm.
The cassis.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
In the mouth, you have the freshness of the Syrah.
Great acidity, really.
Yes.
Tremendous.
Good balance.
Yeah, mm-hmm. good balance. And the peppery notes that you were talking about, I feel them even more on the palate. Yeah, a lot of berries.
Yeah,
absolutely.
On
the nose, right? So this you would say this is sort of an entry level wine as well.
Yes, yes, an opportunity to drink a wine from the northern part.
Mm?
The northern part being very tough in terms of viticulture. Mm. We have steep vineyards, etc. At a moderate price.
Yeah. So this is the next step from the Côte d'Rhône.
Yes, we can say so.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Then we go to.
The other side of the Rhône River.
Mm?
So Cruz Hermitage is on the left bank.
Mm?
We switch to the right bank, and we reach Saint-Joseph, which is for me a fantastic appellation, and we have here an example of one of the very best Saint-Joseph, if not the best Saint-Joseph in the appellation, called the Vin de los Pis.
What is the characteristics of Saint-Joseph, you would say?
Saint-Joseph can be an appellation difficult to understand because it's extremely long. It's more than 50 kilometers long. And there are really two poles in Saint-Joseph.
Mm.
You have a northern pole next to Condrieu, around the village of Chavanet.
Mm.
And you have a southern pole, which is the historical pole of Saint-Joseph, right in front of the Hermitage hillside. Despite the fact that we are in the north, next to Condrieu,
mm.
Chavanet, so we live in Ampuy, our vineyards and our sourcing is only from the southern part
mm.
of the appellation. So everything we produce in Saint-Joseph is coming from, the area of Tournon-sur-Rhône, which is in front of Tain Hermitage.
Okay, okay.
So this Saint-Joseph is a single vineyard named the Vin de l'Hospice. It's the former vineyard of the Hospice. People might be familiar with the Hospice de Beaune.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the vines are owned by the town
mm-hmm.
of Beaune, and they're sold in auction. In the case of the Vin de l'Hospice, it's a monopoly. It's the former vineyard of the Hospice that we are very fortunate to own. So it's an outstanding property of 3.5 hectares only.
Yeah.
So it's very tiny. But it's producing a very, very specific and very interesting Saint-Joseph.
Nice. Would you say that Saint-Joseph is a difficult appellation to work with? Because I think that I've tasted some Saint-Joseph and some are really, really good and some aren't really there.
It is true that there's an heterogeneity in the appellation, which is important. That's a fact. So we have to work hard in order to make sure that everybody makes fine wines to go in the right direction. But also, I think Saint-Joseph does not have the chance that Cruz Hermitage has.
No.
Because in Cruz Hermitage, there's a magic word. And the magic word is Hermitage.
Mm.
So when people hear Cruz Hermitage, they hear Hermitage as well. So they think of the Rhône Valley, they think of the Syrah.
Mm.
When people hear Saint-Joseph for the first time, they could locate Saint-Joseph somewhere between Saint-Émilion and Saint-Véran.
Mm.
That is to say, it's a saint, okay, but nobody has a real idea where is Saint-Joseph.
No.
And Saint-Joseph is, among the very best hillsides on the right bank of the Rhône Valley.
Yeah.
So we have a quality potential in this appellation, which is absolutely tremendous.
Get this sort of a stony minerality.
Absolutely. So we are in a slope of granite.
Yeah.
A very distinctive species, a very distinctive kind of granite here in this sector.
Mm.
Unique to the Vin de l'Hospice, so it makes of this wine a
a unique example of the expression of this soil.
Mm. Wow, this is a beautiful wine.
This is a beautiful wine. To be honest with you, this Saint-Joseph being considered as a luxury Saint-Joseph, this wine tasting blind is very hardly described as a Saint-Joseph.
Okay.
It's always described as a much better wine, such as a Côte-Rôtie or an Hermitage. But in a blind tasting, it's the tricky wine to guess because it has, you know, such a balance and such quality in the texture of the tannins that people very hardly consider it's a Saint-Joseph.
Again, this perfect combination between the spices and the red berry, red and dark berries and
absolutely.
All that.
Absolutely.
And the finish is very, very long finish.
Very long finish. The technical point I'd like to make here is the fact that this wine has spent 30 months in New York barrels.
Okay.
But
that much.
But you've not noticed.
No, not at all.
Simply because we have, you know, a very strong experience and a strong knowledge about barrel aging. We've always done long-term barrel agings, and it is so important to us that in 2003 we have taken the decision to start our own cooperage. So we're a unique example in the Rhone Valley of a winery owning its cooperage.
Okay.
So we do the barrels ourselves. That's the best way to control everything.
Yeah.
To control the origin of the oak trees, to control the drying of the staves, to control the toasting, of course, etc. So it's a very small cooperage located at the Château d'Ampuy, but let's say it's very high-quality, profile-oriented. And
11 as a vintage, this was a 2011?
Reliable. Extremely reliable. People have to realize that we're not Bordeaux.
No.
So I know 2011 in Bordeaux is very average. A lot of people, you know, went for the 2010. The 2010 are truly amazing and outstanding in the Rhone, but 2011 is a beautiful vintage, extremely classical. Not like the 10s that were very powerful, very structured. The 11 is much more balanced and classical, I would say.
Nice. And then we're going for...
we're reaching Côte-Rôtie.
Yeah, we're reaching Côte-Rôtie. Yes, we are.
With the first Côte-Rôtie tasting being the Côte-Rôtie Brunet Blonde from the fantastic 2012 vintage.
You're mentioning now Brunet Blonde. could you tell the listeners about that?
I'm mentioning Brunet Blonde because if, you know, terroirs can sometimes be a little bit complicated or tough to understand. In Côte-Rôtie, it's rather simple. We have two sectors in the appellation. A first sector called the Côte Blonde, where we have soils made of schists, limestone and silica, and another sector made of more clay, iron oxide, manganese in the soils. So let's say the Côte Brune shows wines with more tannins, with more power, more structure. So the wines from the Côte Blonde always appear to be elegant and sexy. The wines from the Côte Brune always appear to be more powerful and masculine.
Okay, well, this is a mix of the both.
Absolutely, it's named Brunet Blonde because we like to pick from both hillsides. Technically speaking, it's a wine where we like to pick everything separate. What's very specific to winery is that we vinify everything separately and we also age everything separately and we do the blend just before the bottling.
Okay.
So we develop each complexity of each sectors independently and then we do the final blend.
Yeah. I don't know if it's true, but it was a story about the Brunet Blonde. There was some king or something that named them after his two daughters.
Yes,
it's a good myth.
It's a very good myth, and the legends are very important for people to remember.
Yeah.
And it's true that we have this beautiful legend saying that at the 16th century time, so this is the French Renaissance time, the owner of the Château d'Ampuy, who was the Marquis de Montgiron, would have had two daughters, one blonde-haired girl. And when she got married, he decided to give her half of his vin, the Côte Blonde, and one brunette. And when she got married, he decided to give her the other half, the Côte Brune. So this is the legend in Côte Rôtie. Mm. And this is what 99% of our visitors will remember.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good way to remember it.
They will forget about the schist, the limestone, the silicon, the iron oxide. But they will remember the two daughters.
Great concentration. I mean, on the nose, it's very, very soft and sort of mellow, you know, but on the palate, it's really just such a great concentration and depth.
I'm very happy that you say so, because I used to say that when you smell the Côte Rôtie Brunet Blonde, you probably smell more the blonde than the brune.
Yeah.
You have the aromatic sense of the Côte Blonde, yeah, that are, you know, jumping out of the glass. When you have the wine in mouth, you have this texture and this structure that is probably closer to the Côte Brune. So it's a very interesting mix.
Beautiful. When you would say this is a typical example of a good Côte Rôtie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a true reference for the appellation.
Yeah, you know, that's the word.
A lot of people discover Côte Rôtie through this bottle for the first time, and of course it's a very important bottle to us because we need through a single wine to show the potential of an entire appellation. It's fascinating to produce this bottle every year.
The next one is also Côte Rôtie.
Yes, it's the Côte Rôtie Château d'Ampuy.
Mm.
So this time we are talking about an estate wine,
yeah,
coming from our very best parcels after touching or surrounding La Mouline, La Turque, and La Landonne, what people call the Lalas.
The Lalas.
Absolutely. Yes. So these are truly impressive and outstanding vineyards. They have tremendous qualities. We keep the same philosophy where we pick them separately, we vinify them separately, and we age them separately. We would do the blends before the bottling.
Yeah.
And we're talking about 7 parcels, 3 in the Côte Blonde next to La Mouline, 3 in the Côte Brune next to La Turque, and the last one touching La Landonne a little bit northern.
Okay.
Côte Rôtie, Château d'Ampuy, 2012,
yeah. So many levels on the nose, so many layers.
There are layers, and there are, of course, different lectures of this wine. If you take it in a very simple way, you have a very aromatic nose, not going a little bit further, and in the mouth, you have a silkiness in the approach and a power expression as well.
Yes, it's almost like leather and meat inside, in the bottom.
Absolutely.
And above that, all this silky fruits.
Yeah, just, so this is, let's say, the simple approach of the wines. If you go more in the details, you realize that in Côte Rôtie, we have the capacity or the possibility to have a little bit of Viognier with the Syrah. So this wine has 7% Viognier.
Mm-hmm.
And the Viognier definitely has an impact on the aromatic complexity of the wine.
Mm.
But more important, I'm convinced that the Viognier has a strong impact on the texture of the tannins. Yeah. And you have a wine here that have a fantastic texture.
Extremely.
It's silky and powerful at the same time, which is very difficult to achieve, of course.
Yeah. Lovely. The tannins are really, I mean, they're powerful, but they're so well integrated and so mature. You know, just round up. So, the last but not least.
Last but not least, absolutely, will be a bottle of the Côte Rôtie La Mouline from the fantastic and already legendary vintage 2010. So, La Mouline is a unique example on the Côte Blonde of a vineyard that lives through history.
Mm.
So it's a vineyard that has got a lot of terraces. It's pictured on the label.
Yeah.
So on the label, you can see the vineyard of La Mouline, and you realize there's a lot of terraces and a lot of walls. Believe it or not, all these walls are 2,400 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So they're dating back to Roman time.
Mm.
It's a vineyard that took its shape and where the Romans started to produce wines there a long time ago. And you have here a complexity in the diversity of the exposures because of a unique shape of a Roman amphitheater shape in the vineyards.
you have the Viognier, 11% Viognier in La Mourgue.
Okay. Mm?
You have the fact that it's also the oldest vineyard in the entire Côte-Rôtie appellation.
Okay.
So we're talking about 90 years old of age in average for the vines. We still have vines dating back 1893. Wow. 1893 are the first replantations after the Philippe crisis in Côte-Rôtie. Yeah. So it's fascinating. It's vine on American rootstocks, mm-hmm. but it's the very first vine planted. And unfortunately, I kept the worst for the end. It's a very tiny vineyard.
Oh.
So La Mouline is precisely 1 hectare.
1 hectare?
1 hectare. It means that in a normal vintage, we would produce around 5,000 bottles of La Mouline.
Oh,
and of course, it's very, very difficult to get this wine because 5,000 bottles is a ridiculous number.
Yeah, I'm honored to be able to try it here. But it's really fresh on the nose. But you start to feel that some maturity in it as well.
Yes, 2010 was a vintage that was ripe, but that also kept a lot of freshness and expresses through very serious tannins.
Mm. This is kind of wine that makes you smile. it's just got everything, sort of. Fantastic balance and concentration. This is amazing.
It's the kind of vintage that makes you smile too, to be honest, because 2010, and I hope you won't be shocked, but what I'm going to tell you is a vintage that is quite easy to achieve. I don't know many wines in 2010 that are horrible in the Rhône Valley or that are horrible in France in general. 2010 was a great vintage in Burgundy, was a great vintage in Bordeaux. It was a very outstanding vintage in the Rhône Valley as well. So we feel extremely fortunate where we have a vintage like 2010 where things appear to be simple and we can make outstanding wines.
Mm. This is truly outstanding and I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to taste it. And this is also the perfect time to say a big thank you to Philippe Gigal for joining us and having this tasting with me. It was great. So thanks and cheers to you.
Thank you very much. I was happy to spend some time with you.
Yeah, nice.
And I'm looking forward to have the possibility to be with you back again when you'll taste the wines in the bottle.
I will definitely do. And for all your listeners, if you ever get the opportunity to taste the Moulin, you should do it because it's perfect.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Skål.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.